Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of July 17th, 2015. When I was a kid, whenever we took a trip in the car, maybe on summer vacation, we listened to a book on tape. And when my brother was little, that often meant something from the series Banicula, which features a vampire rabbit that sucks the juice out of vegetables. And that's pretty much all I remember from Banicula. Except for one thing. At the end of each book in the series, the dad always said this: adventure is good for the soul. And that phrase stuck with me. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week's show is about adventure, both intentional, like leaping out of a plane, and unintentional, like, say, you live in Greece and are a passenger on that country's wild economic ride. Come tell us about the adventures you've had, or, since it's summer, maybe one you're about to take. You can write us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org, going to our Facebook page, or tweeting us. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. So, back to that adventure theme. That's the sad truth of what a lot of Greeks are living through right now. An accidental adventure. Not knowing where their economy will end up or what their place in it will be. My colleague Kai Rizdahl has been reporting from Greece about the exact moments when a national and international crisis touch people's daily lives. And we asked him to come talk to us. Welcome back, Kai, to the show and the country.
Yes, thank you. It's good to be back to both.
You spent a lot of time reporting over the past week in Athens. What's your takeaway from this trip to Greece?
Couple of things, Lizzie. The first is it's just the biggest mess you've ever seen, right? I mean, the numbers, you know, economy down by 25%, unemployment at 25%. The thing that really hits me, though, is how desperately these people want it to get better. It's been 5 years now. They can't find jobs. They can't find work. You know, our fixer over there, the guy who took us around, was a theater and media studies major from a university in the UK. He's working now for us, you know, running around and introducing us to people, you know. I mean, they will do anything they can to get by. That's the big takeaway.
Are there moments or images that stick out in your mind?
Two of them, really. The first is that almost all the people we spoke to, except the young college students, they almost all had kids, and all of them basically said, you know what, I'm out of luck. It's not going to work out for me. I now have to try to improve things here so that my kids will have an opportunity. They have given up is a little strong, but not all that strong for the mood, because as you know, this new bailout that they're going to get or in the process of getting is not going to make things better economically in a hurry. And they have to play the very long game. And for a lot of these people, that's their kids.
You also brought us back some tape. A woman who you spoke to who has children. Yeah. Tell us about her. Set us up what we're going to hear, and then let's hear from her.
So we went out. Basically, what we did for 3.5, 4 days was went out in the morning and started talking to people, stopping them on the streets, going to offices, buildings, cafes, whatever. Sunday morning, we went out and we decided that period of time was going to be our ATM line time. We were going to go find people in ATM lines and go talk to them.
60 euros a day max.
60 euros a day max, that's right. Unless, as a different woman told us, she doesn't have 60 euros. I said, is it a real pain? And she said, if I had 60 euros, it would be a pain. I don't have 60 euros. But anyway, so we're out in a lower to middle income neighborhood away from the central business district of Athens where all the tourists are. And we stopped this woman on her street. She was out walking with her husband and her daughter. And the first question obviously was, excuse me, do you speak English? A very high proportion of people there do. She said, yes. Her name is Eleanor Secungulo. She's a teacher. And the first question I asked was, what are you going to do about this? How are you going to handle it? And here's what she said.
What? I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe it's time now to explain to my daughter that the situation is difficult, so her needs must be less, and we will live with what we have.
Six-year-old daughter, again, she's taking it to the next generation, right? But how do you explain to a six-year-old that unemployment is at 25%, right? What does that conversation sound like? It was a lovely little area, lots of cafes, and they were reasonably crowded. And so we kept on talking for a while, and I asked her as we were wrapping up, I said, is there a way – with this new bailout, with the hope that there would seem to be, is there a way that this gets better? And here you go.
Because of all of these things happened the last 3 weeks, I really don't know. I don't know if there is a hope. I don't know. I really don't know.
Again, doesn't know. She just doesn't know. There's so much uncertainty there. You know, and I said this on Marketplace on Tuesday, or Monday, I guess. You know, the thing that the markets and economies writ large hate is uncertainty.
And uncertainty.
And what you have in Athens right now, even with the bailouts, and even with everybody paying attention, is a big, giant hairball of uncertainty. And that's what these people are living with.
Kai Rizdahl, host of Marketplace, who was reporting from Greece for us. Thank you so much, Kai.
You bet. Happy to do it.
Kai mentioned walking around Athens, talking to regular Greeks to get a sense of how this crisis is affecting their lives. One person whose story stuck with us was this student, Anastasios Pinakoulakis. He's 23 and studies theater at the University of Athens. He also has a teaching certificate in primary education.
But right now there are no jobs for teachers. So even if you're a teacher or a doctor, maybe you should be a waiter in a restaurant for not much money. So we have 4 salaries in the house, but we cannot pay all of our bills. My dream is to be a teacher, but it's not possible for many years. So I do other jobs, like I used to work in a bookstore. This summer I was working as an animator in a hotel and cleaning tables, but the salaries are pretty low. When I was in college, I was dreaming of renting a house and living more like an adult and not like an adult child of mom, waiting for her to cook and sitting in the same table in my 23 years old. And maybe working in a public school and use my ideas to make some changes in education.
We're in the middle of summer, and while some people are off on vacation, a lot of us have that creeping suspicion that we just can't get away from work. Whether it's money, guilt, or perhaps thinking that no one else can handle whatever it is we're currently obsessing over. Katie Dennis is senior director at Project Time Off, an advocacy group with the U.S. Travel Organization that researches and promotes the value of taking time off. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I am about to go on my first real vacation since I came to Marketplace about 2 years ago. I just figured that out before I stepped in to interview you. How long do most people wait before they go on a vacation? Or how much vacation do we take?
Well, hopefully not 2 years. My goodness, I'm glad you're going to change that pattern. That's great. You know what? It's really interesting. When you look at how much vacation we've taken historically, there's this idea of the storied American work ethic, and that's always been part of the fabric of our country. But we looked at data from Bureau of Labor Statistics that starts back in the 70s. And from the 70s to about 2000, we have this really static trend line of taking about 20.3 days of vacation. And then we start to drop off, and the drop-off has not slowed. So in just the last 15 years, not even 15 years, we've managed to lose almost a full work week of vacation. So we're down to about 16 days a year. So this idea that we've always been this way is not actually true. This is a relatively recent phenomenon where we're taking so much less time. And
well,
it's something we're trying to dig into.
What is prompting that?
So there's a lot of things that are behind it. A lot of it has to do with technology. The other piece of it is we went through some hard times, and I think people are not necessarily as confident. And we see in our surveys a lot of this post-recessionary thinking is still lingering. So You've got people saying things like, well, the work is going to pile up if I leave, and no one else can do the job, and I don't want to be seen as replaceable. These are top inhibitors to people taking their time off. And a lot of this could actually be cleared up if we would talk about it a little bit more. Because as much as we've talked to employees, we've also talked to company leadership, managers, HR leaders, trying to get a sense of what they think about the issue. And what we're finding is they are overwhelmingly positive. They know all the benefits of taking time off. They know it's good for their employees. They know it's good for the team environment, which is something incredibly critical from a management standpoint. But they don't talk about it. Because when we ask employees, okay, what do you hear from company leadership, your manager, about this issue? 2/3 of them say, I don't really hear anything.
And we should note that Project Time Off is supported by a consortium of travel companies, leisure companies, that there is, I guess, an economic interest in this as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a huge boon for the economy. Is it going to benefit the travel industry? Of course it is. But it's also going to benefit the retail industry, the restaurant industry. I always say my receipts when I go shopping before a trip are criminal because I've spent far more than I should. Everyone's got a stake in this, but really there's a ton of jobs that could be produced from this as well.
Americans have a slight tendency, I think, to sneer at some other countries that have, you know, 30 days of paid vacation or say, well, we've got this, you know, legendary work ethic. And yet, what do we know about how we stack up in terms of productivity with other countries that do have, you know, 10, 20 days of paid vacation?
So, you know, most people, when we talk about this issue, they're like, well, we're not going to be France.
Right.
No one says we have to be France. We can be the U.S. 15 years ago. You know, it doesn't have to be a massive, massive overhaul of everything that we consider normal. I actually was just looking at the typical hours per week worked that the OECD.
Organization OECD for Economic Cooperation. Yes.
Yes, those 37 countries that they look at. But Germany was one of the lowest hours per week worked countries out there. And I think everyone really highly regards their economy, Greece in particular. But that's something that, you know, is kind of interesting. They're highly productive, but they're on the lower end of hours. Because I think at a certain point, if you're overworked, your productivity drops off. There's tons of studies to show that. So it's one of those things where I know I went through that when I had my first child. I put in way more hours before, but then, you know, daycare does not care about my work life whatsoever. And my productivity, if anything, I feel like it went up and I had to leave by 5 every single day because I think I was much more focused and much more driven toward a deadline. Vacation and planning can do that for you. You know you're working towards something. You know you've got to get it done. It really does generate a lot of productivity both before you leave and after because you've got that much more energy coming back.
Katie Dennis is a senior director of Project Time Off. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We wanted to use tech to have an adventure out of the office. So we're exploring geocaching, basically using GPS technology to go on a real-life treasure hunt.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Lizzie.
Where are we?
We are near the bottom of Manhattan. We're on an adventure today. We're talking about geocaching.
Would you like to explain who we have with us?
Yeah, so we have somebody who's much more of an expert than me. I've seen geocaching on at least one Real Housewives show and have talked to a couple of people about this, but I've actually never done it. And we are standing with Brett Rogers. Hey, Brett.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So right now, we're in the middle of a puzzle cache. We've solved the first stage, so we knew where to go next.
And we came from Trinity Graveyard.
We came from the Trinity Graveyard. We learned some interesting things about colonial history, and we watched some gravestones, and we broke some code. And now we are nearing the finish line of where hopefully there will be a geocache waiting for us.
And this happens in steps, right?
Yeah, you start at the website. You go to geocaching.com. There's listings for all sorts of geocaches listed all around the city, all around the world. Some of them are very straightforward. Some of them say, go to these coordinates and look around and here's a hint. Others have a lot more complicated steps involved. Others might say, here's a puzzle you have to solve to figure out the first part of the coordinates, or you need to solve this series of clues before we'll tell you where to go next. This is one that involved a little bit more puzzle solving, so this is the kind of geocache that I tend to gravitate towards more.
Why did you get into doing this?
Well, so I was introduced by my brother, Kevin, who's a real outdoorsman, and he has always had GPS receivers for actual work and things that are, you know, useful.
GPS started as a military technology.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the technology existed, and it was opened up for civilian use, but it was intentionally scrambled because the military, understandably, has some concerns about people using their technology against them. But in May of 2000... President Clinton decided to descramble much of the signal, and overnight, everyone's receivers went from being good to within about 300 feet to being good to about 30. So now you had a situation where all of a sudden people had toys that were 10 times better than they were before, and it was, what are we going to do with these? And so someone had an idea to hide something in the woods and post some coordinates and leave some interesting things inside and post them to the internet and say, hey, I did this. Why don't you come follow my footsteps and solve the clues and find the treasure? And that's kind of where it started.
I'm totally into the sort of national treasure aspect of this. After looking at the Masonic symbols in the graveyard,
yeah, absolutely.
I'm down.
I think the very idea that there's something that's sort of hidden in a city that has, you know, 8 million people in it, and you know a little bit about it, and not everyone else does, and there's clues you have to follow. It's like when you see movies like The Goonies, and you just think to yourself, I want that to be my life. And certainly when you're 12 and you're watching that movie, you really want it to be your life. And I think a lot of us just kind of still have a little piece of that left.
Sure.
And this is a way to kind of tap into that a little bit. You know, if you can give yourself a little bit of a cinematic experience, I think it makes for a much more exciting week. So.
Nick Cage won't be at every single geocaching adventure, but we can at least, his spirit is here.
What were the instructions that would have brought us here?
First, we found James Leeson headstone in the Trinity Graveyard, which had a Masonic code on top of it, which had puzzled people in real-life New York for a long time, but now we know what it says, and it says, Remember Death. We used that information to sort of plug back in some information that was on the cache page and some other coded letters, which, when we combined all that information, it said to go to a small park, Greenwich and Edgar, and look at the bench in the northwest corner.
And that guy just got up. Can we go over and look at it?
The bench is now free.
Can we go over there and see what's there?
Okay.
All right.
We're going to freak this lady out.
All right. So do you think... Oh, man. So this does feel northwest. We're in the northwest corner. We're at the edge of the bench. Lizzie, should one of us start reaching under there and see if...
Is that what we're supposed to do?
I don't know. We're so lucky to be with the guy who designed this, so
you
I don't
do
have
it,
to
man.
Put my hand into some gum. Okay, I'm going to go down on the ground here. Oh, this is awkward. There's nothing under here.
Maybe go to your right, buddy.
Oh, I think I see something. Hold on. Okay, so it's like coffin-shaped, this thing. I'm pulling out a tag. Okay.
Oh! All right, so we got this little tag, and it says, Geocaching, congratulations, you found it, intentionally or not. This is a playing piece for a worldwide game dedicated to GPS users called Geocaching.
Wow. This is cool.
Ah,
there's
if you
some
found
other
the container by
here.
Accident, you're welcome to join us. Just put it back, basically. And what's
that
little guy?
That is a path tag calling card that someone has left behind, and this is a logbook.
Oh, it's a logbook.
Oh,
so just
sweet.
Like on the top of a mountain or something, you...
Right.
We
that's
can
exactly
log our...
Right.
Look at all those people who've logged in their visits.
Oh, there's a lot of people in here. What do you say, Lizzie?
Yeah.
I mean, we sort of cheated, but I think we should still sign it, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I think you should...
I think the rest of our summer has been plotted out for us. What do
yeah,
you think, Lizzie?
I agree.
All right.
Brett Rogers, Ben Johnson, thank you very much.
Yeah, this was a fun adventure.
Yeah, thanks. It was fun.
Last year on this show, I ate grasshoppers with a Mexican chef.
The grasshoppers are crunchy.
Yeah.
They're very crunchy. They're really good.
Thank you.
What should I try next?
That experience shows that one way of getting adventurous without traveling around the world or bankrupting yourself is through food. The business of adventurous eating has exploded with TV shows, eating clubs, and food blogs. Kat Kinsman is the editor-in-chief at Tasting Table, a cuisine website, and she's here to tell us about the business behind food adventures. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking about the business of adventurous eating. And when you look out at the landscape, it feels like that has grown a lot in, say, the past decade. Look at Anthony Bourdain's success, Andrew Zimmer, the kind of stuff you guys publish. How big is this industry now?
Well, I think first we have to define what adventurous eating is versus
what is it?
Well, there's stunt eating
that
is out there. And there are a million YouTube channels devoted to that, finding the grossest, nastiest, biggest, whatever it happens, hottest, whatever it happens to be out there. So when you're talking about adventurous eating, I think you're talking about something that is very, very aspirational, that probably a lot more people do from their couch than they do in actual life. But it's such a pleasure to go along a journey. I mean, my notion has always been you can talk to absolutely anybody in the world about food because that's the one thing we all have in common that everybody eats. So it's really a lens through which to look at the world and look at travel and look at other cultures. It's just part of a conversation we're having. And I think that, a whole lot of factors, including TV, the internet and things have just opened up the world to all of us. And this is a great way to jump into it.
My producer was talking about a year in his life where he said he felt like the Travel Channel was on 24/7, and it was this series of vicarious thrills that are accessible now.
It is a lot of thrill, but it's also, I love when it's done incredibly well. It also tells a story about where the people are. You see, what Anthony Bourdain is doing for, our alumni of CNN.
Yes, we both work together at CNN, we should note.
Where he is telling the story of various cultures by sitting down and having meals with people. Andrew Zimmern uses his platform. A lot of people think of him as just from Bizarre Eats or Bizarre Foods, how, he's just sticking crazy things in his mouth. What he's actually doing is really pointing to folkways and foodways and the people who are preparing these things in a traditional way and having conversations that way. So, while it might seem like this extreme, far-flung thing, what it actually, it's closer to home than anything else, because they're really, when you see, they are going out to stalls, they're going out to restaurants and things, but when it's really, really good is when they're eating at somebody's home.
I think one of the key questions here in a landscape where a lot of people could go out and take an Instagram picture of their dinner is, what elevates this to art? What elevates it to adventure?
Oh, that's a really good question, because right now it really does feel like it's all about the documentation of an event rather than the experience. But what elevates it to this adventure and things is, see if you can talk to the person who cooked it, find out, ask them, where should I eat next? A little game I like to play with myself whenever I'm traveling is to, if I get in a cab, ask the cab driver where they like to eat. And I am a person who likes to do a certain amount of planning, figure out where my meals are going to be, but I like to leave a certain amount of it up to the people who really are in it day after day. And I've found some really pretty incredible meals that way.
In thinking about this, there seemed to be a strange economic confluence for me, that a lot of the interest in adventurous eating and food and doing it vicariously also came at a time when the economy wasn't doing that well. During the recession, people kind of got these peaks into the rest of the world. And so I wonder what it is about food that sort of made that happen at the same time.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I was having this conversation with a colleague yesterday. We were talking about a new video series, and he wants to go and try in New York, try food from around the world. And I said, I think the most interesting way to do this is going to be the thing that is comfort food from other countries. By definition, it's something that maybe you wouldn't usually get in a restaurant. They happen to serve it here for a population who feels separated from where they are. So it's probably going to be, more inexpensive ingredients, and it's a connection sort of thing. So I think, especially here in New York, when people couldn't necessarily physically go to the places that they were seeing on TV, they just didn't have any money. They stayed in New York and they decided to cook in at home, one, and two, you take the 7 train out and go other places and find how these particular populations, a lot of whom probably were immigrants, maybe who didn't have a whole lot of money, fed themselves, fed their families, and really, sustained themselves in a whole lot more ways than just the mouth and the stomach.
Okay, so you brought a snack for me today, an adventurous snack
for us.
Okay, what did you bring?
Well, so I was thinking, what is adventurous? And it's so relative. My husband wouldn't get anywhere near this, but he is adventurous in all kinds of other ways. This is a snack that, weirdly, when I was moved to New York in the late 90s, and I was absolutely broke, hungry half the time. It was not cute. I knew that if I went shopping in Chinatown, I could afford to feed myself. And I got hooked on this snack of little dried sardines. They're so flavorful that you only really need a few and you feel like you've had a little satisfying adventure. So I went out, and these are actually Japanese, but they're individually packaged little containers of dried sardines that are head on and staring at us.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, wow. They're like 20 little fish in here.
Yes, there are. And these, and they have sesame seeds in them as well.
And eyes. Hello, fish with eyes.
What you think?
I like them. I think I'm slightly unnerved by the fact that
they're staring at me.
But they're pretty good. Not gonna lie.
Yeah, and I mean, that's pure protein right there, and packs a lot of, that word, umami, in there. A fish-phobic person would not enjoy this. My husband would be absolutely reeling. He hates these sort of flavors, but, a little adventure here.
Yeah. Kat Kinsman, editor-in-chief of Tasting Table. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adventurous eating, whether you're doing it yourself or watching someone else do it, might feel kind of benign stacked up alongside this next story about a more literal business of adventure, making money from people paying to jump out of an airplane. Our producer, Eliza Mills, went to the desert in Southern California to learn about the business of skydiving.
Well, what we're going to do is she's going to be on his back. And we're going to do a so-called wingsuit rodeo. So he'll basically fly in his wingsuit. She will ride on his back. And I'll chase after them and film them. We're at Skydive Paris. We're at 11,000 feet. And we're just about to jump out of this plane. You coming with us?
That was John, a skydiver from Iceland who's vacationing in Paris. He's one of many seasoned jumpers here today, riding along with first-timers. Skydivers flock to Skydive Paris. It's a huge complex, complete with wind tunnel, restaurant, bar, pool, and skydiving school. Even in the low season, on a weekend day, 80 first-time jumpers might take a leap. I didn't jump, but I did meet up with Skydive Paris's general manager on the ground to talk about how he runs a business.
My name is Dan Brodsky-Chenfield. I am the manager of Skydive Paris. Skydive Paris is one of the largest skydiving centers in the world, and we have new students and skydivers all from the local area all around Southern California. Right now we have people here from Canada, from Iceland, from England, and this is a slow time of year.
When did you start skydiving?
I started skydiving in 1980.
Why?
Because I wanted to fly, and I always dreamt of flying, and when I saw pictures of skydiving and film of skydiving, it looked like the closest that mankind had ever come to true human flight.
What did it feel like the first time you jumped out of a plane?
The first time I jumped, all there was on the first jump that you could do was static line. Now we take people on tandem jumps where you're actually hooked to the instructor and you free fall together for close to a minute. There wasn't anything like that in 1980. It was a static line with an old round military-type parachute, and you went by yourself and you hung outside the airplane, and it felt absolutely terrifying to me the first time. I was thinking, this is the craziest thing I have ever thought about doing in my life, but that free fall and flying that I saw looks so fabulous and so fascinating that it's going to be worth doing the jumps that it takes in order to learn how to fly like that.
So you kept jumping.
I started when I was 18. After 1 year, I became an instructor. Soon after that, a pilot, a parachute rigger, and kind of every different thing that you can do at a skydiving center for work.
So how does the business of Paris work?
I mean, we are a recreational facility the same way that a ski slope would be. It's a tennis club, a golf course. Some people come and just do it once because they just want to experience it, but there's many more people that this is their sport of choice. They come every weekend, they're on teams, and there's people here from 18 to 85 years old, from every conceivable walk of life, every economic background, every different type of job, every ethnicity, quite a wide range of people.
How much does it cost to get skydiving?
Your first jump, if you do a tandem jump, is $199.
How about after that for some of the more seasoned jumpers?
It's generally $26 a jump once you have your own equipment.
What does that money go towards on your end?
Did you look around where you are? This is Skydive Paris. This is one of the largest skydiving centers in the world. We have a fleet of 7 aircraft. We have one of the most advanced skydiving schools in the country with the top skydiving equipment, with the top instructors that you can find. We have an airport of our own. There are probably 100 people who earn their living here. There is no other entity in Paris or in this area that attracts people from all around the world and all around Southern California and the United States the way that Skydive Paris does. We'll have people come that stay for weeks and months at a time. They're staying in the hotels, they're eating at the restaurants, they're going to the movies. And I don't think there's any other operation in Paris or within 30 miles of Paris. It has people that travel around the world like that and support the local economy to that degree.
What keeps people coming back, do you think?
It's the greatest sport in the world. People think that skydivers are just here for the adrenaline rush, but I've got over 26,000 jumps. If I still had the same adrenaline rush I did on my first jump, I would have had a heart attack by now. It's not about that. It's you learn to fly. You feel like you're flying in free fall. And it's that feeling of human flight. It's that sensation that we're all in love with. And there's nothing like that feeling at all. And that's why we have people, again, from every walk of life. We had a guy come, his name was Vern Maynard, did his 100th birthday. For his 100th birthday, made a skydive. And then he came back for his 101st birthday.
Is he the oldest skydiver you've ever seen?
He is the oldest skydiver I have ever seen and the coolest dude I've ever met. I mean, it's you know, we have daughters and mothers and grandmothers and everybody. You could imagine there's just some rare genetic disorder that makes you think you're a bird.
That was Dan Brodsky-Chenfeld, a professional skydiver and manager of Skydive Paris. To see and hear more from our trip to Paris, check out marketplaceweekend.org. And we want to take a minute to say goodbye to Eliza, who is leaving our show but staying in the Marketplace family to produce tech coverage. We'll miss her smarts, sensitivity, and creative touch very much. This week's show is all about adventure, but now we're going to look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan. Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is...
$720 million.
That's how much it costs to send the New Horizons probe to Pluto.
But before you freak out about the price tag, consider this.
Construction of the new Minnesota Vikings stadium is projected to cost around $1 billion.
So a trip to Pluto costs less than a football stadium. Seems like a pretty good deal to me.
Six.
That's how many world powers...
The U.S., U.K., France, China, Russia, and Germany...
reached an agreement with Iran to curb its nuclear program.
Ages 17 to 25.
That's the age range of employees Starbucks is looking to hire at its first ever location in South Africa.
But they're not the only company looking to expand. Krispy Kreme plans to open 31 locations in South Africa over the next 5 years.
Hey, 17 to 25? We're both young enough to apply.
Okay. Yeah, we're both totally young enough to apply.
A slightly different segment for you now about the adventure that is success in the music business. Run the Jewels is the hip-hop duo formed by rapper-producer Jamie Moline, better known by his stage name, LP, and Michael Render, better known as Killer Mike. They came together in their late 30s after they'd each had years of ups and downs in the industry. They join me to talk about friendship, success, and money. Killer Mike, LP, welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I'm just curious, what did you think when you heard a business show wanted to talk to you?
They got
to
have the wrong group.
Yeah, wrong number.
Why?
We're artists.
Yeah, we're artists. I mean, we do business, but we've said it before, we're not primarily a thinking operation. We just kind of do things that we want to do, and then we figure it out afterwards.
There's no grand master evil plan that we had set up that we knew we'd take over the world by giving an album for free. It just felt like the right thing to do as an artist and as former kids who just loved rap music in this new environment. It just felt right. So, and I've never been good at posing as a businessman like a lot of rappers do. I just Run the Jewels operation is an operation ran by the heart more so than the mind.
You just called yourself a former kid, and I'm curious, since you guys are...
I noticed that too.
Well, so you guys are about my age. You both had success when you were younger, and then you wrestled with not having it. I'm curious how you think about money now and whether that's changed.
Interesting thought. You know, I think that at least for me, I would say that that's sort of the way it was, but not really. I mean, you have to think we've actually been having our careers this entire time. It's not like we went and worked at, UPS. I think of money the same way that everyone thinks of money. I like to be as free as possible in this world. And if the game is that you have to collect a bunch of green pieces of paper in order to be able to be autonomous and not have to deal with people you don't want to deal with, I'm going to go get that. I love making money. But I just think at this point, both Mike and I agree that we're not going to do it unless we feel right about it or unless the surrounding, circumstances are that we're happy. You know.
Mike, what about you?
I used to think money made me happy, and then I got a lot of it, and I lost a lot of it, and I was still happy. So I realized that it wasn't money that was making me happy. I was already happy. Money is a tool to be used, and It's used to take care of my wife and children. It's used to invest in my retirement. It's used for me to open and run business, and I've learned the art of money. Now, I'm happier with security, knowing that I have a good savings now, knowing that my wife and I are making intelligent decisions with our money. But I was already happy, and I've better learned to use the tool that is money now to keep me free of business deals that I don't want to be in, to keep me free from the stress and strain of bill pay, and to provide a better life for my children and my wife. So money is just simply a tool, and I'm glad that I've mastered some aspects of using that tool and what isn't, and I'm not being foolish or wasteful like I was when I was younger.
Yeah. Ooh, boy.
Yeah, you think about the money you went through.
So let's just take a moment let's take a moment of silent reverence for the money blown in our 20s.
Yeah.
What did you blow it on?
Me? Drugs, strippers, you know, whatever I wanted that I wasn't a man of deep vision.
Yeah, when you're 20 years old, you waste it on what all 20 years old. Everything you think you want, everything from stuff you order online. I'm from Atlanta, the capital of the strip club, so I put a considerable amount of women through college, I'm sure.
An apartment that's too expensive, you know.
Yeah, cars that aren't worth the next year what you pay for. You know, just all the stupid stuff. You know, when you grow up working class or poor, you have a fantasy of buying stuff. And when you first get money, you indulge that fantasy and you can overindulge.
Right. Because you can't actually see anything bigger to... Yeah. There's no bigger picture. You know, it's like, wait a second. Last week I had no money and now I have $5,000.
I needed this pink fur coat.
I'd probably be fine with $1,000. Let's just take that $4,000 and make a couple memories, fellas.
Well, wait a minute. I want to ask you guys, though, about the business now, because you've both been in the business for a while, and artists get compensated very differently now than, you know, when you were in your 20s. So where does the revenue come from? Where are you making money from? You put your music on the internet for free.
We do, and we also put it on iTunes, and we also put it on every streaming service, which we have direct dealings with because we're not signed to the major labels.
And we tour very hard.
And we tour very hard.
250 days a year.
We've sold almost 100,000 copies of our album.
We sell a lot of T-shirts.
Physical. And T-shirts, and, you know, and that's with giving the record away for free. The idea for giving the record away for free was an acknowledgement of the reality of the industry and also a strategic manipulation of it, you know. We make money off of everything. Record sales. We make money off of streaming.
Merchandise.
Merchandise is huge. We make money off of shows. It's huge. We make money off of licensing. We make money off of, you know, we've turned this into a real, you know, job for us that is lucrative by literally letting go of some of the old sort of fashioned ideas of what the industry is. I think it was really just a recognition of the fact that all bets are off to a degree, and goodwill and connection with the people who would be supporting you is the most important currency to have, because at the very least, they're going to allow us to do this thing that we love, and that's what drives our lives. You know.
Let me ask you guys. You know, Mike, you're black. Elle, you're white. You grew
what?
Up being
what?
In love with hip hop.
What's going
what?
On here?
Being in love with hip hop as a teenager. I'm curious what kind of conversations about race you guys have together.
Huh.
Honest ones.
Really honest ones. I mean, we're very close as friends, you know. Our friendship is so easy that there's and rooted in so many things, so many aspects of our personality and our history and the things that we love and the conversations we have. But it does come up. We're very aware that even us having a public friendship and even us having a chemistry and making music that works is a powerful thing to some degree for people to see, especially in times of confusion and you know, strain.
I think everyone should have a friend of a different class, culture, or race. I think you can view people like, oh, they're cool as groups of people and don't bother them. But if you don't have a Muslim friend, you know, you're not as progressive as you think. If you're black, you don't have a white friend. If you're white, you don't have a black friend or an Asian friend. If you don't have
if you're straight, you don't have a gay friend.
Yeah. If you don't have someone from outside of your social circle of comfort, then you could be doing more. And that's just that simple. I encourage my children. They have different friends. I encourage adults, young people, because I think that actual growth comes out of human experiences with people versus looking at data or being a voyeur on the news saying, well, those people are good or bad. either way, you're still a voyeur and you're out of that world. You should put yourself in the world of someone else so that your world grows.
I want to change tack slightly just because marketplace, we do this thing where we do the numbers, which is partly the stock market, but we're kind of obsessed with numbers. So why did you guys title your albums? Like, why are we talking Run the Jewels 1, Run the Jewels 2? What's with the numbers as opposed to a fancy title?
It's pretty complicated. The first one was the first album. The second one was the second album. You'll probably need a computer for this. Are you in front of a computer?
For my part, I'm a huge Zeppelin fan, too. And I always love the fact that Zeppelin's first 3-4 records are just Zeppelin 1, 2, 3, and 4. You know,
it was absolutely. That's classic. And also was, in a lot of ways, there was no pretense with these records. It was literally, we weren't even trying to sell it to you. It was literally like, so there was something about just the just cleansing ourselves of any type of pretense that really meant something to us for that project. Like, it was just first of all, the first one was just Run the Jewels. Yeah. So when it came time for the second one, it wasn't, you know, we couldn't, what was, you know, Run the Jewels, The Revenge. You know, you just get a little bored. You know, eventually your own, you know, pseudo creativity, it seems more interesting to not be creative, you know. We thought it was funny.
Yeah, and the focus is always the symbols and the album background. And I think that just calling it Run the Jewels 1, Run the Jewels 2, you focus on the art more. You focus on, you know, you don't get hung up trying to understand a title. I think that the whole package is just more palatable that way. Hmm. So Run the Jewels 3 will be next year.
All right. So my colleague Kai Rizdahl does this thing where he asks people to describe their jobs in 5 words. What would you say your jobs are?
I don't work at all.
Trying to find sleep time.
Those are pretty good.
Giggling high with Killer Mike.
Making mad dough with LP. Rocking shows, spitting flows, gone.
Ooh, I think we have to end it there.
Respect.
Killer Mike, LP, thank you guys very much.
Our pleasure.
Love and respect. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Finance might not always sound like the most adventurous thing in the world. A lot of it, on a personal level, is about budgeting and saving and making choices. And for most people, it means dealing with a bank. But there's a new crop of technologies that are creating multiple different ways to handle money. Think of this segment as adventures in money. We're talking fintech with our senior technology correspondent, Molly Wood. Welcome back.
Thanks. Happy to be here again.
Okay, this term fintech, what is encompassed in all of this? Because it keeps popping up, but I need you to kind of walk me through it.
Yeah, it is very broad because fintech is short for financial tech, but it's mostly being used in the context of new companies that are technology-oriented and that are essentially disrupting some traditional sector of the finance industry. And they're taking away some of the tasks that traditionally have been the purview of the big finance industry, and specifically banks.
When we look at what banks do, you know, they make a lot of their margins either on trading or on lending. So how does fintech change the financial landscape? And I guess to what degree does it actually change it?
What we're seeing now is that fintech startups and new technology companies are taking a bite out of lending, like you said, lending fees. They're enabling peer-to-peer lending. So they actually match up somebody who's looking to borrow money with either, ironically, a bank or a wealthy individual who's looking to lend money. They're also taking over payment processing for companies like Apple Pay, or there's a company called Stripe that handles payment processing on the back end and sort of takes on that job and makes it a lot easier and better looking for a vendor like Uber. And then, of course, there's peer-to-peer payments, the ability for you to send money to your friend or send money to your landlord. And those are all traditionally things that banks have done. But when you walk back the cat all the way to sort of the beginning of the money trail, the banks are still there.
When you look at the access to fintech and what is out there, How is that evolving? I mean, what can I use now on a smartphone? And are these the kinds of things that you could see becoming staples in everybody's daily life?
I really do. You know, particularly, I think the most powerful sort of consumer application that people are encountering is this idea of peer-to-peer payments. The idea that you can use an app like Venmo or now even Facebook Messenger or Snapchat or Square Cash to just send money to anyone. I mean, it just couldn't be easier. You maybe tie it to your debit card or to a PayPal account. And when you need to pay somebody for dinner, you just shoot them over the money on your phone right there before you even leave the restaurant. That's sort of the easiest and most obvious incarnation. After that, you may discover that you want to consolidate some credit card loans that have a really high interest rate. And so you get a loan from a company like LendingTree or a company like Prosper that's a lower interest rate. And that loan was put together with investments from a bunch of different sources that could include an individual like me who maybe has, I don't know, $2,500 that I want to invest in something other than the stock market. So it just becomes a sort of interesting loop that allows for all kinds of things that didn't exist before.
There are two kind of barometers that I want to explore here. One is, and I know you track this, the amount of venture capital that is going into companies like this, because that gives us a sense of what the appetite is like in the future. And then I think the other thing that I'm curious about is whether the hangover of the financial crisis, certainly in young people who use a lot of mobile apps, makes them more likely to be okay with using this stuff if they're still distrustful of banks.
This is a big sector, and I think that it's got a lot of potential. You know, there are several of these companies that are already, about a dozen of them, already valued over $1 billion. There are some, according to The Economist, about 4,000 fintech startups. It's definitely a hot sector. And when you talk to investors, they like to be in companies that are always going to have a reason to exist. And people are always going to be dealing with money. The trust is almost the same. I mean, if you ask somebody which company they have a higher opinion of, do you prefer JP Morgan or do you prefer Facebook? You might find that they prefer Facebook and that they are more willing to conduct a financial transaction because, like you said, there is that hangover effect. There is that kind of negative perception. And if you can find a way to avoid paying fees to your bank with some high-tech solution, I think for people who are used to engaging with technology in that way, financial transactions become kind of an obvious next step. And they also become a tool of control. Some of these apps and some of these services are around managing your own money in a way that's more transparent, more user-friendly than calling a broker and paying someone thousands of dollars a year.
The theme of our show this week is adventure. And so when you think about what's out there and kind of on the weirder or more adventurous edges of fintech, what do you see?
I think it's going to be weirder and weirder that you could use a personal, just a messaging app to start to send someone money. But it's also very powerful. And I will tell you that I personally use this app called Square Cash to pay my rent. And it is disconcertingly simple. I open up this app. I type in a rather large amount of money because I live in the Bay Area. And I essentially text my rent to my landlord.
Wow.
This is the future.
You've seen the future and it is now.
And it is easy.
Molly Wood, senior tech correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure.
And that's our show for this week. Next week on the show, we'll be looking at the places where we seek shelter in our cities, lives, and our wallets. Our show is produced by Jenny Ament, Raghu Manavalan, and Eliza Mills. One more fond farewell to Eliza as she moves into producing more of Marketplace's tech coverage. We will miss you. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer, and Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.